Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, "Local Officials Urge Community to Continue Wearing Masks," by Caitlin Randall. Midland officials asked residents to continue wearing masks and taking other coronavirus precautions during a press conference Tuesday, a day before Governor Greg Abbott's statewide mask order and business occupancy limits are lifted. "The state's not going to require us to wear masks anymore, but that doesn't make it any less important or any less valuable to public health advice," said Russell Myers, CEO and president of Midland Health. "So here we are today to ask our community to continue to stay the course for the foreseeable future." He said they would have a better idea of when masks are no longer necessary after more of the population is vaccinated and following guidance from the CDC. There were 15 COVID-19 patients at Midland Memorial Hospital on Tuesday, the fewest there has been in a long time, Myers said. He said that number is about 6% of the hospital's total capacity. Larry Wilson, health authority for the City of Midland Health Department, said there have been fewer than 20 confirmed coronavirus cases each day for the last 3 days. However, the health department reported the 241st COVID-19 death this week, which Wilson said is a sober reminder that the pandemic is ongoing. "The biggest thing we can be doing right now is getting shots on arms and getting people vaccinated," he said. To those who qualify for the vaccine but have been reluctant to sign up for it, Wilson said, "There is very little to no risk in getting vaccinated and far more benefit to be gained by being vaccinated and protecting yourself and others." Mayor Patrick Peyton acknowledged during Tuesday's press conference that the governor's mask mandate had never been enforced in Midland. The Midland City Council twice considered mask ordinances, but voted down those down both times. Peyton said the drop in confirmed cases and hospitalizations is evidence that residents have been following coronavirus guidelines without enforcement. "We have really fought well over many, many months, and we have been running this incredible race," he said. "We really want to slow walk ourselves back into opening and not just take off. Let's be cautious and not go crazy here and ruin what we have achieved together." He said masks will continue to be required inside the City Hall building. This article is entitled, "Oil Bulls Who Stayed Course Through Freefall Reap Rewards," by Michael Belusky, Bloomberg. An oil glut coupled with a virus-induced freefall in global demand sent energy stocks spiraling a year ago. Now, as the world begins to recover from the pandemic, oil bulls who stayed the course are enjoying big returns. The move is turning some fund managers' gaze back to Canada, where oil producers were clobbered a year ago, with even blue-chip names such as Suncor Energy Inc. losing two-thirds of their value in a matter of weeks. Improved Canadian oil pricing and fewer worries about pipeline capacity has funds such as Bison Interests LLC redeploying capital away from U.S. shale and into Canadian energy companies. The Houston-based fund, which has risen about 90% this year, is bullish on names such as Tamarack Valley Energy Limited that have exposure to Alberta's Clearwater oil play. Josh Young, Bison's chief investment officer, said the economics of the region are better than the Permian Basin. "It's probably the most economic onshore resource play," he said. Bison seeks out disconnects between stock prices and the intrinsic value of a company and was able to deploy capital during the downturn, he said. The OPEC Plus decision last week to keep output largely unchanged, along with an attack on the world's largest crude terminal in Saudi Arabia, briefly sent Brent oil futures above $71 a barrel early Monday. Futures in New York sagged on Tuesday, with West Texas Intermediate crude for April trading at $63.76 a barrel as of 4:15 p.m. in New York. Investors are increasingly confident that any oversupply will be absorbed by soaring demand as more people are vaccinated and life slowly returns to normal. The fear of peak demand is leading us to the reality of peak supply, said Eric Nuttall, senior portfolio manager of the Nine Point Partners LP Energy Fund in Toronto, which has gained about 70% this year. There was less planning involved in last year's oversupply. Last March, coronavirus lockdowns began in Western economies just as Saudi Arabia began flooding the market with oil in an all-out price war. Energy equities plummeted. At one point, Canada's energy index was down 53% for the year. It's risen 19% to start 2021, with Vermilion Energy Inc. being among a handful of stocks that have risen over 60% during the same period. Then in January, in one of his first acts as U.S. president, Joe Biden canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, the type of move that would normally be a major setback for the patch. But with construction underway on other pipelines, the Canadian portion of Enbridge Inc.'s Line 3 online, and a drive for profitability through spending cuts, bulls have sent signals that this cycle may be different from its predecessors. Nuttall, whose holdings include MEG Energy Corporation and NuVista Energy Limited, says he thinks Canadian energy stocks have more upside versus those south of the border, where a new Biden administration is more hostile to fossil fuels. At the same time, Canadian pipeline capacity is improving, despite the Keystone XL decision. Nuttall said that small to mid-cap shares have aided his fund's performance this year. Generalist investors who seek to own assets in a wide range of industries have avoided oil and gas stocks because of price volatility over the last few years. Stabilizing prices could change that equation, Nuttall said, as margins increase and other equities become overvalued. We've selectively added energy as energy companies cut spending amid rising demand, said David Picton, chief executive officer of Toronto-based Picton Mahoney Asset Management, which managed about $8.9 billion Canadian in client assets at the end of February. In an interview, Picton called those investments more of a trading call, because he's not convinced that energy is a good long-term bet. This is the oil page. This article is entitled, Oil Deepens Retreat After Recent Rally Flashes Technical Warning, by Andres Guerra-Luz, Bloomberg. Oil pulled back from recent multi-year highs after technical indicators showed crude rallied too far, too fast. Futures in New York fell toward $64 a barrel on Tuesday in choppy trading, following a surge Monday to the highest intraday level since 2018 after attack on a major Saudi Arabian crude export terminal. Prices rose above the upper Bollinger Band during the last three sessions, signaling a pullback was in store. Meanwhile, the U.S. government expects domestic crude production to rise, drillers take advantage of oil's price recovery. Crude's rally just kept pushing and pushing and pushing, said Edward Moya, a senior market analyst at Oanda Corporation. Then we had the OPEC surprise and the Saudi attack, triggering the last key surge where now a lot of the recovery in demand expectations due to the vaccine success has already been priced in. While a technical dip was expected in the short term, OPEC Plus output cuts are seen holding the market over until demand comes back in force. Standard Chartered PLC said the producer group's supply restraint will likely even over-tighten the market. Still, concerns remain over how much higher prices can go without destroying demand. India would prefer oil to be on the lower side in the range of $50 a barrel to $60 a barrel, according to Mukesh Kumar Surana, chairman of Hindustan Petroleum Corporation, one of the nation's biggest refineries. Further price gains from output cuts have pretty much run their course, Doug King, RCMA Group chairman, said in a Bloomberg television interview. You can tighten as much as you want, but if you destroy the refining margins and product demand isn't there, then effectively you really don't get much further up the chain. In the U.S., crude inventories are expected to rise for a third straight week, according to a Bloomberg survey. Gasoline and distillate stockpiles are seen decreasing. The industry-funded American Petroleum Institute will report its supply tally later Tuesday ahead of U.S. government data on Wednesday. In the U.S. shale patch, Chevron Corporation plans to ramp up investment in the Permian Basin through 2025, reversing the pandemic-driven production decline, the company said in an investor presentation Tuesday. In its monthly short-term outlook report, the U.S. Energy Information Administration raised its domestic oil production forecast to average over 12 million barrels a day in 2022, growing faster than previously expected. The EIA outlook also said crude prices should decline next year, with global oil supply surpassing oil demand during the second half of 2021. While the agency raised its Brent price forecast to $58.51 a barrel in 2022, it sees the benchmark falling from a 2021 average of $60.67 a barrel. The concern is, the more OPEC maintains these cuts and allows prices to rise, at what point is that problematic? Said Rob Hayworth, senior investment strategist at U.S. Bank Wealth Management. Eventually, we've seen that gives rise to shale producers coming back on some time horizon. Meanwhile, heavy maintenance on North Sea oil fields is helping erode the flow of crude to Asia from some suppliers in the Atlantic Basin as a key price spread between the two region balloons. North Sea supplies will be significantly constrained throughout the second quarter by routine maintenance programs. This article is entitled U.S. Officials Report on Oil and Gas Sale Ban Due by Summer from the Associated Press. Billings, Montana. The Biden administration said Tuesday that it will deliver an interim report on its suspension of oil and gas sales from federal lands and waters by summer. But officials declined to state how long the moratorium could remain in place. A long-term ban on lease sales from the nation's vast publicly owned oil and gas reserves to address climate change would fulfill a campaign pledge from a Democratic President Joe Biden. The prospect has rankled Republicans and petroleum industry representatives who have said that Biden is putting tens of thousands of jobs at risk as the economy reels from the pandemic. Oil and gas from federal reserves in western states and the Gulf of Mexico make up about a quarter of U.S. production. Lease sales to companies for drilling have been a frequent target of lawsuits from environmentalists who contend officials have ignored the oil and gas program's climate impact. Biden announced a temporary suspension of new sales 1 week after he took office. Tuesday's announcement offered the first details of a review of the Interior Department program that officials said will examine climate issues and whether taxpayers are getting a fair return on sales of energy leases to private companies. Last month, the administration postponed lease sales in the Gulf and four states, Colorado, Montana, Utah, and Wyoming. the federal oil and gas program is not serving the American public well. Interior Department Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Laura Daniel Davis said in a statement, "It's time to take a close look at how to best manage our nation's natural resources with current and future generations in mind." The administration has pledged to spend billions to assist in the transition away from fossil fuels such as oil, gas, and coal. Biden has said creating clean energy jobs is a top priority. There is no estimate on how long the review could take, agency spokeswoman Melissa Schwartz said. Even a short-lived suspension on leasing will quickly affect companies, tying their hands as they seek to make drilling plans for coming years, said Eric Melito of the National Ocean Industries Association, which represents oil companies operating offshore. "We will begin seeing companies starting to make decisions that will shift investments and jobs out of the U.S., Melito said. "The longer a suspension goes," he added, "the more susceptible the administration will be to legal challenge." Democrats, environmentalists, and left-leaning policy groups said the leasing program has remained unchanged for decades and needed to be reformed in the face of climate change. "The oil and gas leasing program is broken, plain and simple," said Jenny Rowland with the Center for American Progress, a liberal Washington-based policy group that has been supportive of Biden's agenda. This article is entitled, "Chevron Revives Million-Barrel Permian Target After Cuts," by Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. Chevron Corporation revived aspirations to pump 1 million barrels a day in the Permian Basin after drastic budget and job cuts trimmed operating costs. Chevron plans to ramp up investment in North America's biggest oil field through 2025, reversing the pandemic-driven production decline, the company said in an investor presentation Tuesday. Chief Executive Officer Mike Wirth surprised investors by restoring the million-barrel Permian target only a year after it disappeared from the company's guidance as COVID-19 crashed energy markets. The California oil titan expects its Permian wells to generate $3 billion in free cash flow by the middle of the decade, assuming international crude prices average $50 a barrel. The region straddling West Texas and New Mexico incurred the deepest spending cuts in last year's pullback amid the oil market's unprecedented collapse. Chevron plans to double returns on capital employed and expand free cash flow by 10% a year, more than twice the cash flow growth rate promised by ExxonMobil Corporation last week. Chevron's dividend isn't imperiled, even if crude falls to $40. "This, in our view, confirms CVX's superior investment case relative to XOM," Giacomo Romeo, an analyst at Jefferies International, said in a note to clients. The London-traded worldwide benchmark traded at $67.83 a barrel at 10:23 a.m. in New York. The main question for investors monitoring the virtual presentation on Tuesday is what Wirth plans to do with the windfall from this year's rally in oil prices. The company has a lower debt burden than its big oil rivals and has shown an unwillingness to take on major growth projects. Still, Chevron has bought back shares in recent years and pursued takeovers such as the $5 billion purchase of Noble Energy last year. "We're investing in only our best projects, funding those that meet our high return expectations," Wirth told analysts. "This improvement is anchored in self-help. We're not betting on higher prices to bail us out." Demand recovery. Chevron was little changed at $109.52 at 10:24 a.m. in New York. The stock has climbed about 20% in the past month, buoyed by surging crude prices and prospects for a recovery in energy demand to pre-pandemic levels. Though Chevron may be in a better place than its peers, The trauma of 2020 will be evident for some time to come. The company's debt increased by 64% to $44.3 billion due to the double blow from low oil prices and weakening refining margins. Chevron also announced new targets to lower carbon intensity 35% by 2028 and eliminate routing flaring by 2030. Cost savings from the Noble deal to double to $600 million. U.S. Gulf of Mexico will have two final investments decisions by 2022. Anchor development expected to begin pumping oil in 2024. Chevron sees an extra 1 to 2 billion cubic feet per day export potential from its Israeli gas fields. The COVID-19 pandemic had a profound impact on big oil, accelerating the push by some down a path away from fossil fuels, while others rode back on long-term growth plans. Chevron was in the latter camp, pledging to spend about 27% less than pre-pandemic levels all the way through 2025. Despite the new carbon intensity goals, Chevron has yet to follow its largest European rivals in announcing a long-term net zero target. Like Exxon, the California-based oil giant is focusing on reducing emissions from its own operations and small-scale joint ventures in novel technologies. Chevron has committed to spend about $300 million on such investments this year, or 2% of its annual budget. Worth has sounded caution on soaring valuations of clean energy startups in recent months. This is the local page. This article is entitled ENAM Launches $12 Million Capital Campaign for Expansion Renovation by J.C. Lewis. The Ellen Noel Art Museum has announced a $12 million capital campaign to raise funds for a renovation and expansion of its building and grounds. The project, designed by local architect R.J. Lopez of Parkhill Smith & Cooper Architects, allows for a modest expansion to the building, as well as restructuring the current space and updating the facility with equipment that addresses the museum's current challenges. Since first opening its doors in 1985, ENAM has served hundreds of thousands of people through its series of exhibitions, educational classes, school tours, outreach initiatives, and family events. The impact of these programs has been felt by generations of residents across West Texas, and with the increase in population, they have the potential to impact more, according to a press release. A feasibility study completed in 2018, combined with discussions about how best to meet the needs of a rapidly growing Odessa, has led the museum board of trustees, staff, educators, and community leaders to determine that the ideal solution is to expand and improve the museum's building and space. Those challenges include barriers to entry. When the museum was designed almost 40 years ago, museums were perceived as stewards that safeguard cultural legacy. Today, museums are gathering places for social and educational interaction. The museum's solid brick facade and hidden entranceways are psychological and physical barriers to entry. There is constant confusion as to where to enter the museum. Focus on function. A key principle underlying the design and reconfiguration of space usage is to increase efficiencies throughout the museum. By rethinking how galleries, classrooms, and event spaces can be used, capacity and flexibility are realized without dramatically increasing square footage. Maintaining industry standards. A key factor in ENAM retention of American Alliance of Museums, AAM, accreditation and Smithsonian affiliation is meeting industry standards in terms of mechanical systems, Many of the building's mechanical systems are original to the initial construction 40 years ago. The following systems have reached the end of their life cycle and require replacement, including HVAC, security, lighting, IT infrastructure, and lack of fire suppression. AAM accreditation and Smithsonian affiliate designation signifies to lenders and donors that ENAM operates at the caliber of a national museum service such as the National Gallery, MoMA, and any other first-tier museum. The only major differences between these cultural organizations and ENAM are size and location. Limited capacity deters growth. Scale and scope of programming is currently limited. Ability to serve our expanding community will increase. Ability to support other cultural organizations and corporate needs will increase. Hinders collaboration. With multipurpose spaces, the museum will be able to support interdisciplinary arts production in the Permian Basin. Curator Daniel Zies said the press release that increased attendance during certain exhibitions shows that the community appreciates the museum and would like more exhibits on a more consistent basis. However, outdated equipment has prevented the museum from borrowing pieces and exhibitions in the past. Updating the HVAC, lighting, and indoor sprinkler system would improve the museum's chances of securing major shows more often, Zies said. The ENAM provides programs with ECISD that have reached thousands of children and reintroduced art back into the classrooms of local elementary schools. Students and educators from Odessa College and the University of Texas Permian Basin have utilized the exhibitions, galleries, and 3D printing lab to enhance their learning experience. Local performers have had the opportunity to perform and showcase their talent during special events. Other cultural, nonprofit, and city organizations have used the museum's space to host their own programs and meetings. Restructuring and expanding the current building would allow the museum to facilitate an even greater number of creative and diverse programs. This is the opinion page. This article is called Guest View. It is entitled, Holding Off on the Vaccine Just Got More Dangerous in Texas, from the Houston Chronicle. If Dolly Parton hadn't already qualified for American sainthood, she stands an even better shot now that she's made vaccination against COVID-19 fashionable, fun, and even poetic. Vaccine, 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 the 75-year-old country singer and songwriting genius sang last week to the tune of her classic song, Jolene. As she waited, perfectly attired in a blouse cut away at the shoulders, to receive the Moderna vaccine she helped fund. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. The closing lyrics, because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. Despite her disarming humor and irrepressible giggle, she said she was dead serious that people holding off on vaccines should take the plunge. I just want to say to all of you cowards out there, don't be such a chicken squat, she said. Get out there and get your shot. We couldn't have said it better. But if Parton's message isn't enough to motivate you, here's some cold, hard, unpoetic truth. It's never been more important to get vaccinated in Texas, a state where only around 15% of the population has received at least one dose, lagging behind the national average, but where pandemic protections such as a statewide mask mandate and social distancing rules are being tossed out on Wednesday. As we've said, Governor Greg Abbott's decision is premature and was based on nothing more than politics. It ignores medical consensus on the vital role masks play in slowing the spread of coronavirus. He has ignored the pleas of Texas's medical community and didn't even bother to consult three of his four medical advisors before announcing the move. It's up to each of us to do everything we can to protect ourselves, our communities, and our family members, including those stubborn loved ones who are eligible for the vaccine but have thus far demurred. The reason for resistance are mercifully falling away. The fact that 90 million doses of vaccine have been distributed in the United States since mid-December, with only rare and mostly minor side effects reported, should reassure holdouts that the shots are safe. Those whose opposition was born of politics can take heart as well. We learned from news reports last week that former President Trump slinked off and got vaccinated before leaving office. Unfortunately, he chose not to share that decision with the many Americans who may have been encouraged to follow his lead. But the revelation may provide delayed motivation. More encouragement came Monday when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued guidelines for vaccinated Americans, giving them the long-awaited go-ahead to gather indoors, with or without masks or social distancing, with other healthy people who have been vaccinated. The okay even extends to visits with unvaccinated people from a single household, as long as all members are at low risk for severe disease if they contract the coronavirus. That's cause for celebration for many Americans, but especially grandparents who haven't been able to squeeze their grandkids or their grown kids in the past year. One caveat is that the visit should be local and not require travel, which the CDC still does not recommend for any American. Hope and normalcy are on the horizon, Texans. That's why vigilance through this last stretch is so important. No more Americans should die needlessly of this horrible disease when it's so close to being defeated. Of course, defeat also carries a caveat. This virus is a wily one and has found ways to ensure its survival through mutation. Houston currently has all five major variations, including the rapidly accelerating United Kingdom variant, which studies have suggested is more transmissible and more deadly. Fortunately, vaccines being administered in the U.S. have proven effective against it. But the South African variant is another story. The most widely used vaccines in the United States appear to be less effective against it, and the AstraZeneca vaccine does not appear effective at all, Dr. Peter Hotez told the editorial board last week. In response, vaccine producers are working hard to develop boosters that can be distributed later this year, said Hotez, a renowned vaccine researcher. What that means, Hotez says, is that all Americans should get vaccinated as soon as possible and brace for another round of shots. The two-dose Moderna and Pfizer vaccines will become three-dose vaccines, and the one-dose Johnson & Johnson will become a two-dose. This virus isn't sitting idle, and neither should any Texan who remains unprotected in this deadly worldwide pandemic. If you're eligible, sign up for an appointment and get vaccinated. If you're not yet eligible, get your name on a waiting list. Your turn is fast approaching. This article is entitled, "Legislation Backed by Casino Giant Would Allow Casinos Sports Gambling in Texas." Las Vegas Sands is pushing to create the opportunity for casinos at destination resorts in the state's four largest metropolitan areas, by Patrick Zvitek, Texas Tribune. Two Texas lawmakers on Tuesday filed legislation backed by the gaming empire Las Vegas Sands that would legalize casino gambling in Texas. The legislation was filed by Representative John Kumpel, Republican Seguin in the House, and Senator Carol Alvarado, Democrat, Houston in the Senate. The proposals would create special casino licenses, for 4 destination resorts in the state's 4 largest metropolitan areas, Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, and Austin. At the same time, it would establish a Texas Gaming Commission to regulate the casinos, tax table games and slot machines, and separately legalize sports betting. The legislation would require amending the Texas Constitution, which currently bans most gaming in Texas. That is only possible with a 2/3 vote of lawmakers in both chambers and then voter approval in the November election. Kumpel is the vice chair of the House Licensing and Administrative Procedures Committee, which oversees industries regulated by the state, including current gaming options. Alvarado, meanwhile, chairs the Senate Democratic Caucus. Las Vegas Sands, founded by the late GOP megadonor Sheldon Adelson, has spent the last few months building a massive push at the Capitol, spending millions of dollars to hire nearly 6 dozen lobbyists. The bill filing deadline for the biennial legislative session, which got underway in January, is Friday. We appreciate the work of the bill sponsors, and we are excited to engage in further discussion with elected leaders and community stakeholders on the possibility of expanding Texas's tourism offerings through destination resorts, Andy Abood, Las Vegas Sands senior vice president, said in a statement. The legislation is consistent with the vision that Las Vegas Sands has laid out for casinos in Texas: a limited number of licenses for mixed-use destination resorts in the state's biggest population centers, with a high minimum investment intended to attract only the best operators. To that end, the legislation calls for a land and development investment of at least $2 billion in Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston, as well as $1 billion for San Antonio and Austin. The destination resort licenses would be considered Class 1 licenses. The legislation would then create 3 Class 2 licenses for limited casino gaming at horse race tracks in Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, and San Antonio. After that, 2 Class 3 licenses would be made available for similarly limited casino gambling at Greyhound tracks in Corpus Christi and Harlingen. The full casino legalization would also extend to the state's 3 federally recognized Native American tribes at their reservations in El Paso, Eagle Pass, and Livingston. They are currently able to offer limited gaming. The legislation also would generate fresh revenue for the state by imposing a 10% tax on table games and 25% on slot machines. State lawmakers face a nearly $1 billion budget shortfall, but Las Vegas Sands has downplayed casinos as a short-term solution to the deficit, instead focusing on their long-term impact when it comes to economic development, jobs, and tourism. While the Las Vegas Sands-backed bills also call for legalizing sports wagering, an alliance of Texas's major professional teams and betting platforms are making their own push at the Capitol and unveiled their own legislation last month. The Sports Betting Alliance is focused solely on mobile sports betting legislation. However, several of our member teams and organizations may support these bills individually and any bills that give Texans the opportunity to decide if they want to regulate gaming in Texas, Kara Gustafson, a spokesperson for the Sports Betting Alliance, said in a statement after the filing of the casino legislation. It remains to be seen how viable the casino bills are at the Capitol. Both Governor Greg Abbott and State House Speaker Dade Phelan have not yet been opposed to the idea from the outset, with Abbott saying he wants to hear from lawmakers about where their constituents are on the issue. But Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has been far more pessimistic, saying last month he has never been in favor of expanding gaming, and the upper chamber is nowhere close to having the votes for it. Polling released last week by the Texas Tribune and the University of Texas found that a majority of Texans support expanding gaming, with 41% backing full casino gambling. Las Vegas Sands has said its polling shows higher support for the destination resort model in Texas and even higher numbers for giving the Texans the option to vote for it. The company has also made it clear it is not looking for taxpayer money to help pay for casinos in Texas. The legislation filed Tuesday says proposals for investment may not include public money or facilities developed or built with public assistance or tax incentives of any kind. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. Donald Ray Luttrell. Donald Ray Luttrell, 88, passed away peacefully on March 7, 2021 in his Midland home. He was born in Hobbs, New Mexico on November 4, 1932 to James J.R. Nick Luttrell and his wife Wanda Irene. Donald Ray Luttrell is survived by three daughters, Dana Luttrell and Carolyn Luttrell, both of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Stacy Klaproth of Midland. Three grandchildren, Julian Gonzalez, Evan Luttrell, and Zoe Klaproth. He is preceded in death by his wife, Nikki Charles Luttrell, and his parents, James Roscoe and Wanda Irene Luttrell. Arrangements are pending. Jean Harvey Bishop. Jean Harvey Bishop, 82, of Midland, died March 4, 2021. He was born October 20, 1938, in Midland, to Claude and Annie. He is survived by his wife Betty, Jeanette, John, Chase, and Caden Strumpfer, Melissa, Carrie, Jeremy, Bethany, and Hannah Earp, one great-grandchild, and many extended family members. A memorial will be held March 13th at 10 a.m. at Cotton Flat Baptist Church. Floral offerings should be taken to the church. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Jessica Woodruff. Jessica Megan Frances Woodruff was born January 14, 1986 in El Paso, Texas, the daughter of Cynthia Roscoe Carlos and Ted Woodruff. Following a brief illness, she received last rites and passed to be with the Lord on March 3rd in El Paso. Jessica was preceded in death by her grandparents, Guy C. and Anna Jean Woodruff, and Joseph and Elizabeth Roscoe. She is survived by and rests in the loving memory of a large extended family, first by her mother, Cynthia Roscoe Carlos, and husband Ben of El Paso, her father Ted Woodruff and wife Olga of Balmoray, and her stepmom Mary Bell Lockhart of Alpine. Brothers and sisters Taylor, Nicole, Travis, Sherry, and Ryan Monica Woodruff, Catherine Martin Sanchez, Kevin Michelle, and Carla Manchuca, three aunts, three uncles, and many nieces, nephews, and cousins. She was preceded in death by her ever-faithful Homer and remains in the heart of her loving companion, Alex Huck. A celebration of the life of Jessica Woodruff will be planned in the near future. Jessica would appreciate contributions in her memory to area Humane Society shelters or to the West Texas Food Bank. Lucius Lynn Boone Stokes. Lucius Lynn Boone Stokes, 91, from Big Lake, passed away on March 7th in San Angelo. He was born August 16, 1929, to Altus Thompson Stokes and Corinne Wood Stokes in Runnels County, Texas. He married Joyce Nunn on August 2, 1952, in Big Lake. He is survived by his wife Joyce, daughter Linda Johnson and husband Dwayne, son Tom Stokes and wife Donna Lynn, two granddaughters, two great-grandchildren. He is also survived by a sister, Frances Roach, and several nieces, nephews, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his parents, son L. Lynn Stokes Jr., and sister Nancy Neenstead. A graveside service will be held on Tuesday, March 9th at 10 a.m. at Old Runnels Cemetery near Ballinger, Texas. John Sparks will officiate. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to West Texas Boys Ranch, 10223 Boys Ranch Road, San Angelo, Texas, 76904, or to a favorite charity. Family and friends may share online condolences at www.harperfuneralhome.com. Luis Madrid Luján. Luis Madrid Luján, also known as Cheto, 63, of Midland, Texas, passed away peacefully on Sunday, March 7th. He was born in Colorado City on April 11th, 1957. He is survived by his son, Luis Luján, and wife, Beatrice, daughter, Agatha Barrientes, all of Midland, 6 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, 1 great-great-granddaughter. Special companion, Rosie Nunez of Odessa, Texas, 7 sisters, 6 brothers, numerous nieces and nephews and cousins. He is preceded in death by his wife, Mary Canero, and parents, Maria and Juan Luján. Memorial service will be held on Friday, March 12th at 10 a.m. at Elevate Church in Midland. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Macy Deanne Oliver. Macy Deanne Oliver, 22, was born and raised in Midland. Maymay was reunited with her Nana, Pamela Ann Bell Rogas, Granny Patsy Marie Wiedes, Uncle Jared Kelvin Bailey, Grandfather Tommy Murphy Sr., and Uncle Tommy Murphy Jr. on February 28, 2021. May was born on October 14, 1998, to Deanne Oliver and Robert Max Wiedes. Maymay had many cousins she was raised with and aunts that loved her so much. May was also the oldest of 4 children, Cassidy Lynn Wiedes, Lauren Robert Wiedes, and Angelica Marie Wiedes. Maymay had a nephew she absolutely adored. Public viewing will be Friday, March 12th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., family only from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Her service will be held at Bellevue Baptist Church and will start at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 13th. Immediately after, May will be laid to rest at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. Instead of flowers, donations may be made to Deanne Oliver. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Ronald G. Manny. Ronald G. Manny, 72, of Henrietta, passed away Friday, March 5th. A celebration of Ronald's life will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, March 10th, in the chapel of Owens and Brumley Funeral Home in Wichita Falls. Ronald was born on November 8, 1948 in Borger, Texas, to the late Jack and Margaret Dias Manny. He is survived by his loving wife Terry Manny, his son Heath Manny, and 2 sisters, Pat Brooks and Margaret Clemens. Condolences may be sent to the family at www.owensandbrunley.com. Virginia Farrow. Virginia Farrow, 77, also known as Jin Jin, met Jesus on March 7th in her family home surrounded by family. Born on May 5th, 1943 in San Angelo, Texas, to Walton and Estelle Harrell. She met the love of her life, Franklin, in Rankin, Texas, and they were married for 56 years. They had 2 children, Kobe Farrow, wife Tracy, and Sally Thompson, husband Macy. 3 grandchildren, Caden Farrow, Casey Thompson, and Tyson Thompson. Virginia was preceded in death by her husband, Franklin Farrow, granddaughter Bailey Mae Farrow, sisters Amaryllis Culberson, sister Barbara Elliott, and her parents Walton and Estelle Harrell. A celebration of life will be held on March 11th at 11 a.m. at Hope Community Church, 3125 Travis Avenue, Midland. Virginia's favorite color was red, and we ask that if you would like to wear an accent of red in her honor. Flowers may be sent directly to the Hope Community Church, 3125 Travis Avenue, Midland. Donations can be made in her honor to Teen Challenge of Midland, 6901 South County Road, 1200, 79706, or the Kairos Prison Ministry. A special thanks to the doctors and nurses at Midland Memorial Hospital and the caregivers of Interim Healthcare of Midland. Death notices. Michael David Kildow, 58, of Odessa, Texas, died Thursday, February 25th in Odessa. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. March 17th at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. Arrangements are by American Heritage Funeral Home. Rosemary Schwope. Rosemary Schwope, 88, of Midland, passed away March 8th. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, March 11th, at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, March 12th, at Mid-Cities Church, Neely Campus, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. This article is entitled, Tesla is Plugging a Secret Mega Battery into the Grid, by Dana Hall and Noreen Malik, Bloomberg. Elon Musk is getting into the Texas power market with previously unrevealed construction of a gigantic battery connected to an ailing electric grid that nearly collapsed last month. The move marks Tesla Inc.'s first major foray into the epicenter of the U.S. energy economy. A Tesla subsidiary registered as Gambit Energy Storage LLC is quietly building a more than 100-megawatt energy storage project in Angleton, Texas, a town roughly 40 miles south of Houston. A battery that size could power about 20,000 homes on a hot summer day. Workers at the site kept equipment under cover and discouraged onlookers, but a Tesla logo could be seen on a worker's hard hat, and public documents helped confirm the company's role. Property records on file with Brazoria County show Gambit shares the same address as a Tesla facility near the company's auto plant in Fremont, California. A filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission lists Gambit as a Tesla subsidiary. Executives from Tesla did not respond to multiple requests for comment. As winter storms pummeled Texas in February and left millions without power for days, Musk took to Twitter to mock the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, the nonprofit group that manages the flow of electric power to more than 26 million customers. "Not earning that R," he wrote. Musk, 49, recently moved to Texas, and his various companies are expanding operations in the state. The battery storage system being built by Tesla's Gambit subsidiary is registered with ERCOT. Warren Lasher, Senior Director of System Planning at ERCOT, said the project has a proposed commercial operation date of June 1st. The site is adjacent to a Texas-New Mexico power substation. While Tesla is known for its sleek, battery-powered electric vehicles, it's always been more than a car company. Its official mission is quote, to accelerate the world's transition to sustainable energy, unquote. Utility-scale batteries are needed to store the electricity produced by wind and solar, but they can also become lucrative opportunities. By storing excess electricity when prices and demand are low, battery owners can sell it back to the grid when prices are high. Tesla has spent years expanding into residential energy technology. Back in March 2015, Musk unveiled a home battery product dubbed the Powerwall, with a splashy event at its design studio near Los Angeles. Scores of utility and energy executives attended. A year later, Tesla acquired SolarCity, the solar panel installer founded by Musk and his cousins. Musk then hawked a solar roof that has gone through several iterations without becoming a strong contender in the market. But the company's product lineup already reaches beyond the home and into the electric grid. The Tesla Power Pack and even larger Mega Pack were designed with utility customers in mind. Texas's battery project in South Australia launched Tesla's battery project in South Australia, launched in 2017, is adjacent to a wind farm and can store surplus electricity generated on gusty nights for a daytime demand. At 100 megawatts, it was the largest battery project in the world at its launch. While Tesla's energy focus often takes a back seat to the increasingly competitive business of manufacturing and selling electric cars, Musk and his executive team continue to highlight energy as a key part of their growth. I think long-term, Tesla Energy will be roughly the same size as Tesla Automotive, Musk said during an earnings call in July 2020. The energy business is collectively bigger than the automotive business. Tesla's battery packs are connected to Southern California's Edison's Mira Loma substation located east of Los Angeles. The 20-megawatt system, which has been online since December 2016, supports grid operation during peak hours and helps the utility make the most of its renewable resources. In the San Francisco Bay Area, PG&E Corporation and Tesla are constructing a 182.5-megawatt system at an electric substation in Moss Landing that should be operational by August. Tesla Energy could represent up to 30% of the company's total revenue by the 2030s, up from roughly 6% today, according to analyst Alexander Potter of Piper Sandler. His research has highlighted the potential for AutoBidder, a software platform Tesla designed for utilities. Tesla Chief Financial Officer Zachary Kirkhorn has described AutoBidder as an autonomous energy market participation system that does high-frequency trading. Potter has a $1,200 price target on Tesla stock, the highest on Wall Street. Tesla's energy storage business on a percentage basis is growing faster than their car business, and it's only going to accelerate, said Daniel Finn Foley, head of energy storage at Wood Mackenzie Power and Renewables. They are absolutely respected as a player, and they are competing aggressively on price. Musk's empire has numerous branches in Texas. And with the billionaire's recent relocation from California, the Lone Star State now appears set to become the center of his universe. Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, or SpaceX, is building and testing Starship, a new rocket and spacecraft designed to take humans to Mars, at a facility in Boca Chica on the southern tip of the Gulf Coast. Another rocket testing facility is located in McGregor, near Waco. SpaceX has posted engineering positions in Austin for a new state-of-the-art manufacturing facility for Starlink, a space-based high-speed internet service. Tesla is also building a new factory in East Austin for its forthcoming Cybertruck, an electric pickup. Gigafactory Texas, as the facility is known, will create 5,000 mid-level manufacturing jobs and is supposed to produce the first vehicles by the end of this year. Musk's focus on Texas comes as the dominant U.S. energy hub, with its abundant natural gas, oil, solar, and wind resources, is being transformed by the surging growth of renewables. For more than a century, the Texas grid has transported power from large plants to customers over miles of transmission lines. The recent storms have highlighted just how fragile that legacy system is in the era of climate change. With the build-out of giant batteries like those made by Tesla's Gambit project and others, the state's power grid could be remade around distributed generation that may prove more resilient. About 2,100 megawatts of battery storage and 37,000 megawatts of solar and wind are in advanced stages of connecting to ERCOT's grid. It's not only stunning, but the financing is already in place, Figar Shaw said on March 2nd, a day before the clean energy pioneer was named as director of the U.S. Energy Department's Loan Finance Office. The Gambit project was originally developed by San Francisco-based Plus Power, a privately held renewables company that has battery operations in several states. Scott Albert, the former city manager of Angleton, said it was obvious that Plus Power was working with Tesla. A project summary available on the city's website features images of Tesla's utility-scale battery product, and some of Plus Power's principal staffers previously worked at Tesla. Plus Power confirmed its sale of the project to an undisclosed party and declined further comment. The Gambit project is not hard to find in Angleton, a small town of roughly 3,000 people in the middle of Brazoria National Wildlife Refuge. But people on the construction site appear to have instructions to avoid drawing attention or answering questions from passers-by. A photographer who attempted to observe from the front gate was told by a worker that it was a secretive project. White sheets obscured what appeared to be Tesla's modular megapacks. In Texas, Albert said, it's common for developers in real estate or energy to begin projects with several potential partners or purchasers waiting in the wings. It made sense to him that the project ended up with the state's biggest billionaire. Elon Musk has a lot of activity in Texas right now, said Albert. It wouldn't surprise me if Musk is thinking about starting his own power company.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.